Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Eric.
And I'm Brittany.
And we are...
For Colored Nerds.
The conversations that black people have.
When white people are not in the room.
But we record them.
And we put them on the internet and in your phone.
And everywhere.
And everywhere. So, welcome back. Here we are.
Yeah.
2017 still.
Yeah.
Poppin'.
Still live. I was going to say still live. That's my only bar.
That's your only bar. Yeah, you know, we're here. But yeah, I'm just out living my life. How are you doing, Eric? I just realized I answered a question that you didn't ask. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm making it. You know me. I stride on like on melancholy. Melancholy and anger is my fuel.
That's so crazy because like it's just I can't do that. It's too taxing for me.
Oh, I enjoy it.
I know. Well, I'm doing pretty good. And you wanted something good?
Yeah.
You wanted something good that happened to me?
Give me something good.
I got tickets to the Black Smithsonian. I'm going to the Black Smithsonian at the end of June.
Yeah.
Even though it is smooth March right now, it is the springtime. I will be going at the end of June, but I'm excited. I'm probably going to not stop talking about the fact that I have tickets until I go.
You know what I appreciate about the Black Smithsonian, as you call it?
Everybody calls it
that. Is that... It's so it's like Hamilton level popping. Like mm-hmm. You have to buy the tickets months in advance. Mm-hmm. Like I just appreciate that. Like that just means a lot to mm-hmm. me. You know what I'm saying? That we're that popping. That like you got to wake up at like you got up at like 9 o'clock in the morning. Or
well,
like
I mean, you know me. I'm already by 9 o'clock. I'm popping. I've done everything. But yeah, no, I had to like have several pages open and constantly refreshing and trying to pick different combinations of dates and ticket numbers so that I could actually get tickets. I was scamming the system, and I got two. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take my wonderful partner. I'm going to take Bay with me to D.C. because he's never been to D.C. He's never seen Howard's campus. He's never been to any Smithsonian, let alone the Black Smithsonian. So he's going to get the full force of my being and identity all in one day.
That's wonderful.
I'm excited.
It'll be a while before I make it out there. It's hard to travel to D.C. with a two-year-old.
That's
not
what
even
I've heard.
Two.
Baby yeah, I was two. Like, okay. I was like, whose child is this?
Yeah. Why don't we go ahead and jump into today?
Yeah. So today we have a super cool, very fun, fantastic guest making his first appearance on Four Colored Nerds. We have with us in the studio senior editor at The Fader, Jason Parham. Round of applause.
What's up, y'all? Thank you.
Thank you.
I know what took me so long to get on this amazing show, but you know, I'm here, out here.
Out here. 2017.
You made it.
Yeah, I was going to say probably what took so long is that Eric and I, we're always struggling just to keep it together.
Yeah.
And
no, that wasn't on your part. It was like on my part. Like I should have been like trying to be on here sooner.
Well, we appreciate it.
Y'all are so popping.
You know what I'm saying? Thank you. We're trying. We're really trying.
The thing that you always tell people that I realize I probably shouldn't tell folks is I'm always like, we just two ashy blacks out here trying to make it, you know? Just trying to make it. So, you know, we appreciate you rocking with it.
We really do. And it is chapped. It is cold outside right now. It is bricks.
You know how cold it is? You know this that time of the year when it gets so ashy between your index finger and your thumb. And you can't, no matter how much lotion you put right here in this crevice, it's always going to be ashy. It's like that cold.
Yeah, I'm looking at my hands right now. We're doing the little rock sign and I see, yep, two white circles.
I always just put extra like Carmex on my lips and then I like creep my hand up there, like just season it throughout the day. But yeah,
it's like a tub of Vaseline. Like. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we're so thankful to have you here. We just want to talk a little bit about you.
Yes.
And I guess first up, if you could just give us a little bit of the intro as to how you came to writing.
Wow. The abridged version. I studied journalism in undergrad. I studied literature in grad school. I came to New York 2010. I came with no job. I was one of those sort of like dreamers, you know, it's like I was tired of L.A. I'm born and raised in L.A. I was living in L.A. and I was just ready to get out of there. My brother and my cousin were living here. They were like, come out. So I was deciding between here and D.C.
You made the right decision.
No, I mean, I love D.C.
I do too, but...
You know, shout out, you know, chicken wings and mumble sauce. Like, I could live off that for the rest of my life. But it just, in terms of, like, publishing and writing, New York is sort of the mecca and the center for that, right? And so I came out here, but I had no job. I had a few freelance things lined up, but I had no steady income, so I was living off my savings for a while. I came in July 2010, and then I got a fellowship at The Voice, The Village Voice, in October, November later that year. And then from there, it kind of like spiraled into editor gig at Complex, editor gig at Gawker, editor gig at Fader, and then sort of like freelance writing throughout those years.
Did you write a lot as a kid? Like, has that always been something that attracted you?
I really, this is going to sound so nerdy. I mean, it's called For Color Nerds.
Go deep.
I love like sentences and sort of the lyricality of sentences and sort of just words in general. I always tell people now because I think I've read so much, right? So I was reading like 4 books a week during grad school.
Wow.
Yeah. So just like at that level. And then so when I got out of grad school, I tried to slow down a little bit in terms of like my consumption of literature. And when I read now, I don't necessarily read for a plot or character. I'm always just reading about how I'm always reading for how writers write, like style, right? If that makes sense. So how do they construct sentences? How does the story like move forward? Like which words are they choosing? And just selfishly for myself to be a better writer. But I don't know if I was ever drawn to writing a lot when I was young. I read a lot. And then I think eventually I was like, I'm not good at anything else. Let me like try to be a writer.
That's kind of how we came to podcasting.
We came to podcasting because you were like, I don't even know, because you asked.
Y'all were ahead of the game, though, because podcasting blew up, but y'all had your podcast before, like, there was that sort of, like,
the
swell.
Boom.
Yeah. Yeah, that boom, yeah.
I have to give Eric credit for that, because that was why he was like, I think something's going to happen with podcasting. We should start a podcast. And I was like, nobody wants to hear us talk.
Well, yeah, I mean.
And then you were right.
Well, gladly, I wasn't right that nobody wanted to hear, nobody wanted to hear us talk. But yeah, I mean, we were both, you had talked about, because you write as well, Brittany. And
sometimes, I don't have the time really to dedicate to it, so I don't do it very much. I wrote something a year ago.
But you, on your own, you often write.
That's true.
You know,
true.
Like personal writing. You don't, you know, publish as often as maybe you should.
You
hint,
know what?
Hint, nudge,
okay,
nudge.
Keep going.
But, you know,
it sound like a black dad.
I'm so glad.
It's my default.
No, seriously, that is like within our friend circle. That is, I'm glad you said that because that is Eric's identity. But continue.
No. But like it gave us like kind of an outlet. Like we were always consuming things kind of in the same way you were in terms of like reading and stuff like that. And I was always just kind of like looking for an outlet. And I know you were kind of like looking to lean into something that would give you some sort of creative outlet, too, which, you know, we were able to start doing this. And turns out we're maybe not good at much else. But
yes, that's true. I can cook and you can raise children. And that's the extent of all the other talents that we have. But we're not doing too bad. But so you mentioned that you had an editor gig at Gawker. And I always read Gawker since I was like a sophomore in college.
Oh,
I was always reading Gawker. From
2007,
I was regularly reading. I went through this phase where I was like, I don't know what I thought I was going to do. I don't know what job it was. But I was just really into consuming media. I think I always wanted to work in media. I got a film degree, so that actually, now I think about it, I'm fact-checking myself. I have always wanted to work in media. But so I used to just consume it all the time. And Gawker seemed like they were always reporting on the media, so I always read them. But something that like I felt a lot was that it wasn't like a place for me. I felt like I was an outsider reading it. Now, some of that has to do with the fact that like, it was about the media industries, and I was in D.C. and I was in college and I was younger and like I wasn't a journalist. But some of it also just felt like me as like a young black woman, Gawker wasn't necessarily a space for me.
But
when you were an editor there, you created this really cool space within Gawker that featured black talent. And, you know, you commissioned a lot of work by Black writers, and you feature them in roundtables about topics like new Blackness or the validity or relevance of Black History Month. And you also interview...
Oh, that was a good one. The new Blackness one was...
You know what? But honestly, real
you
talk,
said it. I was like, oh, here we go.
No, that went around like the group text and the email.
That did go
like,
around the group text. Know. The new Black did that go around the group
off,
text.
That one went off the rails. But I mean, as new Blackness does, you know, it's you know. Filling itself.
But also, I mean, the fact that a conversation like that, however you feel about it, even if you feel like it's cringeworthy now, the fact that a conversation like that was happening on a website like Gawker to me was like, that blew my mind. You know, in addition to doing all that, you also interviewed Black writers and Black people who otherwise might not be featured on Gawker, like Margot Jefferson, you know, who wrote Negroland.
Right. Shout out to Margot Jefferson. That was one of the best conversations I've had, actually. I could talk to her on the phone all day.
I mean,
forever shout out to Margot Jefferson.
Just like out here really doing it.
Yeah.
No, that was an interview
with
that
the Pulitzer. She has a Pulitzer, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, if she doesn't, she has one for me.
Yeah.
why was it important for you to create that? Like, why was it important for you to sort of carve out that space and maintain
it? Right. So, I mean, shout out to Max Reed, who came on as editor, or he's promoted to editor. And he was like, I want to sort of take the site in a new direction. And I think they were looking to bring people on who could help diversify the voice of this site along racial lines, along religious lines, along class lines. Mm-hmm. And just like, push conversation in a new direction where Gawker really hadn't gone before. Mm-hmm. Not to say that there hadn't been writers there that had been doing that, because I think Court Jefferson did a lot of that during his tenure at Gawker. Katie Weaver had done some of that, even behind the scenes, pushing for conversations around Blackness, even though, you know, you butt heads a lot with people in charge. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I was specifically hired to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And Gawker is very self-enterprising, where it's like they hire smart people and they're just like, work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of micromanaging. They're just like, we trust you to bring in good stories. We trust you to interview good people. And we're just going to give you the platform to do that. And me, it's like, okay, well, I know all these talented, amazing people. Mm-hmm. I know all this, you know, this family around me. It's like, let me like tap into that and access them during my time there. And so a lot of it was that, just having sort of like these conversations on a platform like Gawker that I would just have with my friends, or people were just naturally interested in, or just like covering things that I'm just interested in. Because if I'm interested in, then I think to some degree other people are as well, right? So that was just sort of my thinking behind it. And it didn't seem like that much of a revelation at the time, but I talk to a lot of people now, and they're like, you really did bring a lot of people through.
Absolutely. Brittany, you kind of touched on it before. Like, that wasn't quite, originally, I didn't see that as a place where I would come to for like the type of content that you brought to it. I'm curious, I mean, you mentioned that like they give you a lot of like room, or they gave you a lot of room to kind of to do, you know, what felt natural to you. But I'm wondering, like, you know, if you could speak to any, like, was there any pushback at all in terms of, even maybe in terms of reception? Like, because their dominant audience seemed to be somewhat different.
Right, a lot of the pushback would naturally just come from the audience, right? So, like, they have sort of this, in the same way that Beyonce has the Beyonce Hive, or, like, Rihanna has the Navy, like, Gawker has this rabid community of, like, white folks.
Yeah.
From all sort of, like, you know, junctures of society that are either like super liberal or super conservative, but everybody sort of, they're all reading Gawker and they all come with these different opinions. And so I didn't realize how huge the platform really was. Like, I knew it was Gawker, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize how much of an impact me writing something would carry and then follow me, right? Mm-hmm. And then I would be accountable for that, these words. Not to say that I was never acknowledged my sort of accountability for my work, but it was just like, you're sort of this hypercriticalness that surrounds the work when you're writing for Gawker, because everybody's eyes are on it, right?
Yeah. And it's built in. Like, I mean, like you said, like the commenting community was like massive.
It's insane, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely insane.
Yeah. And it's weird also how they, almost more than most publications, like, centered that comment community and like in a lot of
Denton, Nick Denton, the CEO, the former CEO and founder, he was during my first year there, they were really big on, it was called Kinja, the commenting, sort of the comment section. They were wanting to make that sort of the centerpiece of the company. Okay. And so there was a mandate for writers and editors to, if you post something, hop in the comments and at least reply to a few people. Mm-hmm. Right. So they wanted us to engage in conversation. Sometimes we did that naturally just because we wanted to like stand up for our work.
Yeah.
Sometimes people didn't because it was like the work speaks for itself. Why am I repeating myself? Mm-hmm. But there was early on, there was this mandate, at least when I was there, that, you know, jump in, talk to folks, get conversation going, which is, I think, good and bad, right? I think for me, though, it's like I'd rather do it when it's more organic, when I feel the need to do it, as opposed to being told to do it. But
yeah, and I mean, something I'm curious also, like if you felt like this relates, is like we talked before, actually, when Clover Hope was here.
Shout out to Clover, who's amazing.
Yeah.
She is amazing.
Just like very silently and quietly, like out here killing it as well.
Absolutely.
Like her, she has a critical eye and a critical ear.
She's been in the game for a minute too, just like.
Yes, she has.
With bangers.
Yes. For a while. For a while.
But like one of the things she talked about, we were talking about Leslie Jones kind of back when the whole thing with Ghostbusters first popped up and a lot of the hate that she was receiving. And she was kind of talking about like just that extra burden that it takes to be Black and in public. And I felt like Gawker was weird in that regards because like it almost cultivated that like within the site, you know, because you kind of described that like the expectation to go in and engage with this commenter community that often, you know, didn't necessarily like the people who were most engaged in the commenting, at least from my observation, didn't necessarily seem like a majority of the people who might be reading the type of work that you cultivated, even though I was one of those people who was reading that. But like, I'm wondering if you, like, if things felt more public for you because you had to go in and then like almost like greet the horde, if you will.
It was scary sometimes. So my only mandate as an editor and a writer has always just been to add more context to the story of Blackness, right? I want to keep diving deeper and deeper. So that's the only thing that sort of connects everything that I do. I've never had a beat, as you call it. I cover race, politics, sports, just sort of across the board. But I've always in some way engaged Blackness. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about very Black things on a very, for its own fault, a very white and male site, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was at times it was very sort of scary to jump in there and sort of engage the public, the horde, because they were hungry and sometimes they were smarter than me. I wouldn't want to admit that, but it was like sometimes they made an incredible point that I couldn't go back on, you know, but it's kind of like you have to stand up for your work. But it was like growing, like you're saying, being Black in public was like growing up in public too, like becoming a better writer and becoming a better editor and becoming more critical of your own work. I think it was good. It's in terms of like how I feel like Complex made me into a person who could just make content anywhere. I think Gawker made me not afraid in the same sense. It's like, I think every publication has given me something different, and Gawker sort of, I think I grew a lot of, you know, tough skin when I was working there.
I want to go back to something that was in the original question that I asked you. When I mentioned the Black History Month roundtable, like, you lit up.
Oh, that was fun, right? Because people kind of think Black History Month is a joke, but I take it very seriously.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to remember who was on that.
Yeah, it was you, Loretta Charlton from Vulture,
Jenna Wortham.
Rembert Brown, Hillary Crossley from Jezebel, and Greg Howard, who at the time was at Deadspin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
In hindsight, that's a squad, too.
No, right? That's a squad. Hey, man, I only put squads together. Like, this is a squad. that was a good one. That was fun. I was experimenting a lot, right? Because I think Gawker hadn't really done a lot of roundtables before I got there, at least that I was aware of.
Yeah.
Right, because they were growing and they were evolving. And I think a lot of Max's mandate was sort of like, let's engage culture from every angle. And so I think roundtables are especially impactful on a topic like this when you have people who are coming from different areas of, you know, Black America, who are coming from who have different histories of Blackness, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're all coming with something different to the table where, as opposed to me, just writing something on Black History Month myself wouldn't be as effective as, you know, five people getting together and like coming with all these different ideas and thoughts, right?
Mm-hmm. Black History Month is, I mean, Eric and I have discussed this at length, and like we had a live show in February that was Black History Month themed. I'm so glad to hear you say that you take it seriously, because I just feel like I don't see any reason.
I mean,
why
the
not.
World is trying to sort of delegitimize blackness, so let's just sort of claim what's ours and be proud of that.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
And I meant to like the black history of like the everyday people now, right? So we know about the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's. Exactly. Let's like get to like the nitty gritty of like the people that are just really doing the work as well, that did the work and are doing the work, you know?
Exactly. And a lot of people like that like are in our own families, are in our own bloodlines. You know what I mean? I think that stuff is so beautiful. And those people don't always, like, they a lot of those people didn't get the recognition when they were alive.
Also, Black History Month this year was extended since Moonlight won. We are now in month 2 of Black History Month.
That's wonderful. I'm with that. I'm
trying
to
get to my 12. See how we can keep this train going.
I want to ask you another question. Actually, pretty much every question I think about we were going to ask you, as with your writing, pertains to blackness. As with the show also pertains to blackness.
Yeah. On message.
On message. But one of your most powerful essays was published in The All in 2015. And it was called A Recent History of Pain. Right. And it was like a series of vignettes just like about black pain and things that happen in your everyday life. Mm-hmm. Tell us the story of how that essay came to exist.
So The All was doing this end of year. Let's back up a little bit. I was let go from Gawker in November 2015. Mm-hmm. And I got a severance package, which was very nice. And I was off basically for 2 months, still getting paid. It was weird getting fired or getting let go from Gawker because it's like, I think it gave me this attitude where I just kind of don't give a fuck anymore about media, where it's like, either you want me or you don't want me, mm-hmm. right? Either you are going to believe in my work or you're not going to believe in my work, mm-hmm. right? So how I was saying gave me sort of this thick skin.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like given me this persona and this attitude where it's like, I kind of, it's just like I'm me against the world, Tupac sort of like mantra. But I was let go from Gawker in November 2015. It was a Tuesday. I'll never forget that day. We got like drinks. It got so wasted after. But
if not then, when?
Like, fuck it. I tried to save y'all. But I made that mirror earlier that day before it happened. I'm sorry. I'm going to get to answer your question in a second. And I was joking with my coworkers when we found that the layoffs were coming. And I was like, they're not going to let go of the black guy, right? Like,
smarter
the one
than that,
black
right?
guy. Like, they're not that dumb. Yeah. And lo and behold. But that happened in November. And then I got hit up by The All. They were doing an end of the year series where people were just sort of reflecting on their year. Mm-hmm. And we had met. We kind of knew each other casually, and he was like, do you have anything for me? And I'd been thinking about this idea of sort of like pain and how it manifests differently in each of our lives. Mm-hmm. Because it's something we don't talk about, or at least something I don't talk about a lot within my family. We don't talk about, I don't want to like blanket sort of black folks, but blanket statement, but mm-hmm. we don't like to talk about sort of like mental health and sort of like things that are crippling our community a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to touch on it in a way that felt very real to my life, but also I think other people could connect with. Mm-hmm. So, which is why the piece sort of is structured in sort of different vignettes. Mm-hmm. And the genius of The All is that they kind of, in the same way that Gawker The All was like, well, you can just do your own thing and we'll just, you know, try to make it as best as that own thing as it is, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was good. I don't know. It was tough. It was one of those things where I'm in my head a lot. So I was thinking about that a lot before I actually wrote a sentence. Mm. So it was almost all written in my head before I'd actually sat down to write it. Mm. But I'm thankful to them. It's sort of talking about mental health and the scene, or opening up with the scene where my friend finds out that his brother has died, and just sort of like then going, you know, into the next scene with Claudia Rankine and being uptown. And there was just a lot happening, and I think because blackness works in so many different ways, I was trying to also reflect that, you know?
I mean, the thing that I'm curious about, like, in that, because, like, you seem now, you know, as you describe it, as if you're still, like coming back to that still is affecting you in some
sense. Right, I don't think it's complete. I think I'm going to keep doing something with it. Mm-hmm. I want to keep it going in some way, but just even doing research on, like, depression or, like, black suicide or, like, it's just very hard. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a while back where I was doing a lot of research because I wanted to continue this and expand into something bigger. Because there's been a lot of great reception for this piece. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things I look back on of all the things I've written that I'm still kind of very proud of, mm-hmm. you know, which I think is at least for myself, is very hard as a writer, looking back on a lot of my work. But it's one of those things where it's like, I'm proud of this, so I want to keep it going. But doing the research for it was just becoming too exhausting and just kind of making me sad. And so I put it to the side for a while. But I do want to keep going, which I think I am always constantly thinking about how does pain manifest for us, right? Because we're living in such a moment that requires so much of us, but that rewards us so little, you know? And so I think, especially now under Trump, where it's like every day there's something new. There's some new attack coming for us or for the people in our lives. So it's very hard. And I think the pain sometimes manifests in very small ways that we don't notice and sometimes in very tangible ways that we can't control.
Yeah. And even now, like, all those things feel magnified, you know?
Right,
like, the things that we see, obviously, we're... Even, like, so you mentioned, like, you know, obviously we're living in Trump's America right now. And, like, I find myself, like, knowing more about, like, policy than I ever have and feeling, like, affected by that in a way that I have never really anticipated. And I found it's almost like it's an outsized relationship to those, like, small everyday stressors of pain that I'm also, like those things feel magnified. There feels to be, oddly, less of a balance in terms of, like, how you approach, like, the different things that cause you pain in a day-to-day life because they feel so, like, frequent now.
Yeah, man, it's super demanding, the frequency with which it's coming at you. It's just hard, you know, not to say. And I was talking to my mom about this. And she was like, we've been through this before. And it's like sort of the older generation is like, yeah, we've done this. Like, it's going to be OK. It seems bad. But like you're saying, it seems so much more amplified now because of the way we live. We live in such an sort of hyper documented state, right, where it's like where it's on Twitter. It's on Snap. It's on the news, which is 24 hours and it doesn't cut off.
Yeah.
You know, it's exhausting and it's fucking hard.
That makes me wonder though, like, what does pain management look like for you then?
I've been trying to figure this out, right? So like a part of me doing this piece and trying to extend it is also me trying to answer it in some way, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of it in the short term has been detachment from everyday things or just saying no to people when I used to say yes. Mm-hmm. Being more selfish with my time, right? Not going out on Saturday because I'd rather chill on my couch and watch, you know, chewing gum instead of like go out and like party.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think I'm still figuring that out, you know, because I think you have to adapt because the world is constantly evolving. So I think the answer to what does that management look like? It's different every week and every month, right? Because so many things are happening and so many things are changing.
And escalating too.
Yeah. Right. But it's also just like putting love back onto the people that you really love and telling the people in your life that you love them because you don't know if they're going to be there. You know, it's just holding those people close. I don't know. It's in a way, it's a survival, you know, it's survival. It's also defense. Being an adult is hard, you know.
Yeah.
It's really just about like being an adult and how hard it is.
It is. Well,
because you're more conscious of all of this now, right?
Yes. Well, not only that, like that's something I've been thinking about recently is just sort of like you're more conscious of everything. And then also like there's nobody to, this is like a classic adult growing up thing, but there's nobody else to depend on. And like if you so choose, or if you are Eric already, like there's somebody who's, you know, who may depend on you, who does depend on you. And it's sort of like you keep looking up the food chain. You're like, okay, like who's going to relieve me? Who's going to tap me out? And like, you can't tap out of it. It's going to keep going. In the best case scenario, it will be like this for another, whatever. We're all about 30.
Yeah.
So like it'll be in the best case scenario, it'll be like this for like another 50 years. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that's scary.
Yeah.
And like but the only like I do get some
solace. Best case scenario, we're all dying at 80.
I'm saying like, you know, they're 50, 60 years. I figured 80 was like a good
modern medicine, you know, we might be out here to like 100.
I know, but I'm like looking at it, I'm like, do I want to be actually I was like, do I really want to be out here?
Start breaking down.
Right. Nobody else is around. All my friends are dead. Like, is it gonna be popping? I don't know. I figured 80 was a good solid. I can hang up my hat.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good. But the thing that does give me some solace is knowing that like I have like more time to get better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is also hard because like the better you get at taking care of yourself, or the more attuned that you become to like even the ways in which you don't make things exactly peachy for other people yeah. or for the people around you. Like it always there's always like a discomfort in like in getting better because you sort of realize, oh, I've been like, I know I feel conflicted about the ways in which I'm fucking up now, but also that hurt is compounded by the fact that you've been fucking up for a while. Right. You're like, oh, I've been doing this for a smooth minute. But like, yeah, like, you know, best case scenario, another 5, 6, maybe 6 decades. But I have time to sort of like, I guess, figure out how best to mm-hmm. mitigate mm-hmm. all of these circumstances.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
It's worth it, but it's not easy.
It is worth it. It is worth it to explore that, though. Like, just always feeling like that reflection. Like, I found so much more, like, a lot of, like, pain, I guess, management is kind of how we've been talking about it. Yeah. We're just, like, reflecting on that. Like, but the reflection and, like, the process of trying to improve, you know, like, it's one that is taxing. But, like, if when you get up on that, like, small little piece of progress, you know what I'm saying? Like, when you have that moment where, like, oh, I wouldn't have done this way 2 weeks ago. Now things are, you know, now things are looking a little up. Yay for growth. Exactly. Like it's definitely worth it.
Okay. So the next question that I'm going to ask is about your current job situation. When you work at the Fader.
We wrote about y'all.
You did write about us.
Megan did that. I think that was one of the first things I commissioned. We were doing something on podcasting. I was like, mm-hmm. You gotta talk to the Color Nerds crew. They're
Thank
so tight.
So, no, we appreciate that because that made it seem legitimate. So,
we're already legitimate.
I called my mama after that piece. I was like,
that was one where I was like,
mom in a magazine.
No, my younger sister, she still hasn't listened to For Color Nerds and she's never listened to my other show at Gimlet. She's like, I'm my family, so that's not the purpose that I serve her. My purpose is definitely not to entertain her. Like, she's not interested in that. But I think she actually did read the Fader piece. I think for her, that was like, oh. She's kind of a music snob. So I think for her, she was like, oh, okay, this is real now. No, but in that, like the Fader does kind of, it's like, I would describe you guys as like a music and style publication. And you guys kind of like set the tone for what's considered cool. And you joked about a year ago on Twitter that it took you 4 months, but you finally turned Fader into a black hair magazine.
I think that's the only good tweet thread like I had. That's the only good series of tweets I've ever done. All my other tweets are terrible, but that's a good one.
No, right? You update it. You can
no, I know
like
every... that's why it's I think fun, but like I'm joking, but I'm not joking. But I think one of the reasons I took the position at Fader. Mm-hmm. So this is after the, sort of the layoffs at Gawker, and I took some time off to just decompress and recharge, and unplug from just working on the internet. You know, so constantly for 2 years at Gawker. But Fader just always had such an important legacy to me. So the way you're saying your sister connected with it, it connects with youth in a way that I hadn't realized, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. And I think we're on the pulse in a way that I think a lot of other music and culture publications aren't. Mm-hmm. And that's a credit to our amazing staff, obviously. And we've been very fortunate in a year that I've, little over a year that I've been there to really do some very cool things. Mm-hmm. We had Serena on the cover.
Yes,
we
did.
Which is like, I still don't believe that actually happened. She's so amazing. And then I got a chance to do a DMX oral history.
Yes.
I tracked down DMX, guys. Like, I found DMX was in a hotel room in Indiana. And I tracked him down.
As you do.
I had been trying to find this man for like 2 months. And people kept giving me different numbers and saying, he's here. You can talk to him at this time. Uh-huh. You get him on the phone. And it was like not happening. And I finally tracked him down in Indiana. And it was like, he was so gracious. He's so amazing. Shout out to Earl Simmons.
Yeah. There was a video of DMX recently that I came out. Every now and again, typically I read the Shea Room does this morning inspiration. But
I read media takeout in the morning. It's fine.
Hey, uh-huh. You know, you gotta
get your black media where you can get it.
Exactly. You gotta have a broad swath. But they actually posted this one video of him where he was at a homeless shelter. Okay. And it had been like. I want to say it was 10 years from like one of his most.
Well, it's Dark and Hell is Hot?
I think so, yeah. It's Dark and Hell is Hot.
It's the first one, yeah.
Yeah, and he was at this homeless shelter and he said that he had been having like a really tough week. And as you know, DMX says he went through it in public, you know, for a long time.
Talking about being black in public.
Yeah
exactly. But he said he woke up that day. And he realized in hindsight what he had accomplished. And he felt like he was like, I could not sit. He was like, I could not sit still and not talk to someone else about what it means to keep trying and keep going. And that's like, I'm like paraphrasing a little bit, but he went to this homeless shelter. I guess it was in the city where he was at this particular time. It was a room full of Black men, and he just talked to them about like his struggle, mm-hmm. and then prayed. And something about that, something about the way one that DMX will give a speech and pray.
Yo, that man is all about his faith.
Like, oh,
he doesn't
man.
Play about that.
It had me all the way together.
Like, he must have said, God bless you, Jason, like 4 times when we were on the phone. Just like talking, and he would just say, you know, God bless you, man.
Yeah. But anyway, shouts out to DMX. That had me good for like a week.
The amount of love, I think that when I did this oral history of his second album, Flesh of My Flesh, Blood of My Blood, and we sort of talked to everybody that was a part of the making of it, but everything, a lot of things people were saying about DMX were this one consistent thread was that he just has so much love to give, right?
Yeah.
And even though, like you're saying, he's been through a lot and he's sort of like gone through all of that in public, mm-hmm. he's still this person who has so much love for everybody around him and his crew, you know?
Yeah.
It's really astounding to sort of, for someone who's been through so much publicly and privately, to just still have love, so much love to give.
Yeah, right? and work
and
diligently.
Wanting to get it.
Yeah, exactly. Right? To get that out. You know, like he could have had that moment like internally and you know, sat with himself, but it was important for him to go talk.
Right.
I never met DMX, but I did meet his wife, Tashira. Mm-hmm. And that, like, being the partner of somebody who's dealing with, like, addiction troubles is likely taxing for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But she spoke of the same thing when she talked about him just being such a loving, good person. Because I guess they had known each other since they were, like, 14 or something like that. And she had, and this was maybe 5 years ago, she still had like a lightness about her that was totally unexpected, like a groundedness and a lightness about her that was totally unexpected. And that, like, you know, I think he was still really struggling a few years ago. And like, I didn't know the particulars of their situation, but like, I was like, from the way that, like, just seeing her physically speak about him, mm-hmm. You could just feel who he was as a person.
Right.
In a way that really, like, surprised me. That I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting to really, like, I wasn't expecting to meet Tashira Simmons and just be thinking that hard about, like, DMX. I was really, you know, there to just see her speak and hear what she had to say. But, yeah, no, like, people like that, like, tend to leave an impression on others in a way that really shines through where you can see their character. And I think that, like, even I think about the photo series that was with the oral history of mm-hmm. DMX. I feel like a lot of punchlines have been made about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And if I think about, like, the past decade. And I feel like that piece was, like, a recentering and, like, recontextualizing him and his artistry.
Right, just sort of putting this humanist back into this person that we knew so well back in the day, but sort of, like you're saying, somebody who's battled addiction, but I think sort of recentering him and just putting up, just like I was saying, how like my one mandate is to just add more context to this conversation of Blackness and like, what is it and how does it morph and how does it grow and evolve and where does it come from and where is it going? It's like, I think a lot of that with the DMX story was like wanting to sort of like humanize him and again in a way, but also just talk about something that we don't, you know, talk about. I think in the legacy of DMX, that album, a lot of people hadn't engaged a lot. And so mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of retouch on that, but in a way that I think, because like we're saying, he's a person who's very about his faith. And I think that album especially is him battling his demons in front of everybody more so than his first album and the ones that came after it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's bathed in blood on the yeah. cover, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sort of like, this is me sort of like going, you know, going through it. So I wanted to like just jump into that again, just, you know, bring up that humanity and that goodness and that faith that we knew that was there, but just sort of like remind people of that. Right. And just bringing it again back to sort of this series of tweets that I do about sort of the Black Hair magazine. And
mm-hmm.
It's sort of the same thinking behind that. It's like, for me, the barbershop and the hair salon has always been a place of royalty, mm-hmm. right, within the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think it's, and I've been, I'm about to give away one of the stories I've been trying to do. I've been trying to like get this in the magazine, but it's been a bit of a fight. But I want to talk about the black barbershop and I want to talk about the black hair salon, but I want to do it in a way that I think puts it on a pedestal that it hasn't been put on a pedestal, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, and I think, because I think this is going to relate to kind of the direction you're going to. You one of your posts recently was about Monochrome.
That is
a short film about, so Monochrome is this, it's a short film, loose, very loose narrative, in terms of most of it is just like kind of scenes, but like, it starts out with this really beautiful, stark portrait of a black man, you know, with the, like the, I actually forgot what the hell you call it. It's not tunic. The cape that they put around you when you're at the barbershop. And they're outside, and you know, and he is like one of the other men is just cutting his hair.
I never really like I had as somebody who's gotten their hair cut every 2 weeks for the last 30 years. Maybe not the last 30. I don't think it was when I was a baby I was getting my hair cut, but at least for the last like 25 years, you don't. I guess I've never really thought about this sort of relationship I have with my barber as being an intimate space, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And I saw it and I was like, oh man, yes.
Absolutely.
I was like, yes, you get it. I was like, thank you.
I mean, definitely, like, honestly, I had neither, literally until I saw this video. But, like, if you really think about it, you know, the relationship you have with your barber is like, this is another man who needs to look at you as you come in and see, like, the best part of you.
Also, someone who's, like, touching your face.
Yeah.
Which is, in itself, a very intimate act, right?
Yeah.
But just the idea of the barbershop as a sanctuary, right? And the hair, you know, the hair, black hair salon is sort of a space of sanctuary where we don't all come in agreeing on things, but we're all in here together and we're going to leave the world outside. But while we're in this space, you know, we're going to put some love on each other. We're going to put some tough love on each other.
Yeah.
We're going to keep it real, but we're also just going to like have a good time too. And I think it's this place I kind of want to explore next. I'm trying to put a piece together, well, hopefully by the end of the year, but I kind of want to, like, give it some real love.
Yeah, you know? For sure. I mean, it's one of the few, like, explicitly safe spaces that we really, you know, have.
Right,
like, you walk in and it's somebody you don't know, there's a hesitation.
There's certain politics to, I will say this, there are certain politics to the black barbershop that are kind of rooted along very rigid lines in the same way the black church is. Mm. But it's still, I think, a safe space in the broad sense of the word.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I know what you mean. Like, there's a lot of, like, sometimes, you know, you're always sitting in and there's a conversation, you're like,
like, it's a generational thing sometimes, right?
Absolutely.
You're like, I don't know, bruh.
I would push back on that just a little bit, you know, like, maybe you should think about this a different way.
I would say something, but you're about to give me a lineup, so maybe I won't say anything, you know?
I need this edge up to not be too close. When they hit you with that alcohol swab, might be too hard.
I never went to a hair salon in a regular way. I've only just at 27 begun going to it, like a hairdresser on a regular basis, because I didn't wear my hair straight when I was in high school, but I am also old enough that natural hair was not popping. There were no products. You couldn't make money off of it. Mm-hmm. So like nobody really knew how to cut it. It wasn't like a thing. So I just didn't go to the hairdresser really at all for most of my young life, probably from when I was, and my auntie did my hair at home when I was a child. And then as a teenager, I didn't really go to a hair salon on any regular basis until now I'm 27. But still, it's like a space where I find myself, because even if you're not getting your hair done, you always have to go pick up somebody who's getting their hair right. done. Somebody in your family right. always owns a salon. It's like bizarre how many times I found myself in a hair salon for somebody who never got their hair fucking done. Yeah. And it's such a specific, specific, specific place.
It's very therapeutic in a way, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's also something too about like the fact that people come in. You come in one state and you leave completely differently.
Right. Even feeling differently.
Yeah, you leave feeling differently. Even if it's just like because you got your hair cut. Like, even if that's the only thing that's holding you together that day. Or just because, like, I don't know, the relationship that you can often have, I think, with a, like, when I think about a salon or a barber shop, like, when you have a person that you go see there, like right now I go see one woman who only sees people one at a time right. in like one room. And it's wonderful because everything happens on time. She never runs late. I'm always done in like an hour and a half, which is a magical experience for a black woman going to get her hair done. It really, really, truly is. But there's like, you know, knowing that you're going to enter a space where you're going to hear from so many different people and see so many different people. And like also like get up in so many people's business. Get up in so many people's business. Yeah, it's just like even if it's like you're kind of like maybe you're listening, you're like, my problems are really not that bad. Or I'm kind of going through this, but I don't want to speak to these people about it. Let me just jot down this advice. It's just it's a space.
It's very transformative on so many levels.
It is.
Yeah. Just like you're saying, sometimes it's just the matter of like getting your hair cut and walking out feeling fresh. Because that's all that's literally holding you together that day.
Yeah.
And you need to get your hair cut. And if you don't, it might be the end of the world, right?
Yes.
And sometimes it's other things that you're battling spiritually or mentally or emotionally, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so important to at least and to my life and a lot of people in my life that it's been so like central, you know, and I want to explore that and give it more love. So hopefully something later this year will be coming.
But yeah, in the meantime, the aesthetics are very pleasing to us. And I think that you have definitely I say 100%. 10 out of 10. Like you have hit the mark. Fader is a black hair magazine. So we appreciate you.
You know, we'd be out here trying to do it, you know.
Okay, so now I think it would actually be a good time to take a break.
Sounds good.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Welcome back. So obviously, in addition to being a senior editor at Fader, where you're able to, you know, commission and edit a lot of online work, you're also the founder and editor-in-chief of Spook.
Yeah, my baby.
Yes, a literary magazine.
The only thing that brings me joy these days.
You gotta have something.
You gotta have that joy, man.
And you're also a co-founder of Brothers and Sisters.
Oh, right. Wow. Yes. I don't think I've ever publicly talked about this outside of like on a podcast. Like,
really?
Like, people will bring up Spook.
Yeah.
But I was not expecting it, the question about Brothers and Sisters.
I'm excited to incorporate that in because it's such a
great
thing. So Brothers and Sisters is this like salon series based in New York, where, you know, people often like come together and, you know, kind of talk about a series of questions or issues or things that are like thought provoking. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome because it's like a very communal experience, you know, where everyone can kind of feel free to share and speak about the things that are kind of going on in their life as they relate to this central theme. And, you know, you guys bring people in and it's just a really great space. Actually, I often some like people have described me or asked me about it, I'm always like, it's the closest I can get to if there were actual like official Black people meetings. Like, this is what I would hope that
like,
they would
be. Meetings
like,
I always joke about with my coworkers, like, how do you know that person like at the Black people meeting?
Exactly.
Like, once a month? What do you mean?
Like, this is what I would hope they would be. But yeah, so like, you know, Spook is this like, you know, paper-bound magazine. And Brothers and Sisters are these events, you know, really like steeped in like group conversation and like shared learning.
Right.
I'm curious as to why it was important for you to kind of create these physical works, you know, if you will, outside of kind of the work you do online.
Right. Brothers and Sisters, Spook actually, I think they operate... They both have kind of the same goals, but they operate in on different frequencies, right? So, like, Spook actually started before, or I was sort of processing Spook and putting it together before I had a full-time job, right? So this happened, and Spook has actually almost been around. It'll be 5 years in June. I think I should, like, do a big party or something.
You should.
Yeah, you definitely should. That's a big deal.
Yeah. So we're going to have a new issue. I don't know if besides tweeting about this and maybe deleting the tweet, we're going to have a new issue in at the end of May, all fiction.
Mm.
So Spook started 5 years ago because I had felt that there were all these amazing and established literary and, you know, liberal journals. But so often you might have a Zadie Smith, you might have a Colson Whitehead, you might have a Juno Diaz, but there wasn't a full book of us. Mm. There wasn't, at least consistently, right?
Yeah.
And I think coming out of grad school, I was around on these, you know, brilliant minds from, you know, people of color. And just knowing folks in my community, I was like, you know, I could put something together. It might not be as idolized as The New Yorker or Granta or Harper's, but I feel like among our community, we could really put something together. And so for a while, I had been thinking about it. I finally just did it when I moved out to New York. And so the first issue was June 2012. And each issue, I try to at least have, you know, a little bit of fiction, poetry, essay. And then it's really just an art journal. I call it like a literary arts mashup, but that's just me like making up words for like branding purposes. but we've been very fortunate to feature a lot of like established authors, but also, you know, up and coming emerging authors. Right. I think one of the lessons I learned putting Spook together was that sometimes you just have to email somebody you're a big fan of because they're a person too, and they might get back to you, but they might not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time they will. Right.
Absolutely. That's how we've gotten a lot of folks on the show. Yeah. Just like, yo, if you don't know us, but we rock it with you.
But, and then sometimes they do know you though, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, what? It's a little like weird, but also great. And so I've been able to do that for the last 5 years. And then Brothers and Sisters started. We're going on our third year. We just celebrated our two-year anniversary last month in February, Black History Month. Shout out to Black History Month again. me and my partner, Sada Ahmed, who's also one of the three co-founders of Everyday People, that sort of like big day party that goes on in New York for the last few years. A few years ago, we were saying we would love to put like the salon style type together that they used to do during the Harlem Renaissance. There's sort of famous sort of literary salons where people just literally just came together and just talked about shit that was happening in the community. And so we started that 2 years ago. Every month we have a different theme or a different issue. Sometimes it's sort of an open-ended forum where, like, because there's so much happening, people can just come and talk about whatever.
Yeah.
But that's been really successful. And I think the sort of idea behind both of them was that, I don't know, I came to New York, I think, I'm always looking for community, if that makes sense, right? And so both of these, both Spook as it's a physical publication and Brothers and Sisters as a monthly sort of like form that happens at Mokada or in Crown Heights at Electro Positive or Uptown somewhere. It's like these are both physical manifestations of me seeking or putting together community and fellowship, right? Because we live on our phones now, we live on our laptops, and they sort of act as these dashboards between us, right? These sort of like walls. I mentioned this in something I wrote this week about how there was this theory put forward by Sherry Turkle in 2012 about in her book called Alone Together, right? And so we have all these new technologies. We have text, we have Facebook, we have email, we have Snapchat, we have Instagram. And the idea is that they're connecting us more, but they're also siloing us more. We're in these sort of siloed places where it's like, we're talking to people, but we're talking to each other in bubbles, yeah. right? Mm. And so we're actually becoming more lonely. And so I think Spook and Brothers and Sisters was sort of like a pushback against that idea that let's bring people together in the real world. Let's put these ideas together, or let's discuss these things in public in front of people and invite people, right? They've been moderately successful, right? It's always, when you said Brothers and Sisters, I was like, in my head, like, not a lot of people know about it, but it's like, I guess people do. It's like sort of, you know, we're trying to expand, but it's, for now, it's still only in New York, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that sells it short a little bit. I've only had the way my schedule often works out, I rarely have a chance to go, but it's one of those things that every time I see, I'm like, damn, I need to try to make that. Mm-hmm. Like, the way these babysitters cost, the way my account
we
is.
We welcome
set up.
Babies. We've had babies in there before. All like, right. It's fine.
All right, I have to bring her out.
She would love it. She loves people.
She loves to talk now, too. Yes. So she might try to commandeer the mic. But, but no, like, honestly, it was so. Like, that was something I hadn't seen before mm-hmm. outside those more intimate spaces, right. like similar to a barbershop or similar right. to, you know, when you just, you know, happen to get lucky and are able to get all your friends over mm-hmm. To your apartment to kick it, you know, like, mm-hmm. like outside of those types of things, I personally rarely have the opportunity to kind of go and just, you know, sit and listen to like a kind of a free flowing conversation mm-hmm. or like, a collection of thoughts or ideas that I didn't necessarily seek out or anticipate. You know what I'm saying? Like, I rarely have, you might know the theme, but you don't know what people are going to say and what you're going to receive. Right. And I think that it's super important, you know, and it's, I've always found it really, really interesting and like, expanding. I often talk about like, you know, kind of expanding the way your brain a little bit, stretching it a little bit. And I often feel like coming into those types of environments and coming into Brothers and Sisters, like it's a great way of just stretching how I think about, you know, even blackness and community mm-hmm. specifically. So yeah,
it's also just again bringing it full circle, a way to sort of how we're talking about pain management. Sometimes just giving people a space to speak, right?
Yeah.
Because they need to just say something or just be around people who, like we're saying at the barbershop, or people at Brothers and Sisters who are going through similar situations, right? And sometimes we don't know that going in, but then after somebody will say something to me or Sada, and it's like, oh, they're like, thank you, I really need this. And it's, in that sense, it becomes very important. It becomes something about bigger than, you know, our initial goals for it.
All right, I have one last question. It's the very last thing. So we asked you sort of like, what do you always want to talk about, but you never get asked about? And the thing that you mentioned that we're going to talk about, we want to ask you about, is Viola Davis's Oscar speech, which, like, I didn't watch the broadcast,
right.
but like, I'm pro Viola Davis. My mother is Viola Davis's. She's the president of Viola Davis. She's every right. single day. My mom is just like, you know, for me, Viola Davis is just a brown skin, strong, smart, up from poverty. You know, she's up there with Michelle Obama to me. Every day my mother manages to weave Viola Davis into our conversation. As she should. I'm a 62-year-old black woman from Detroit, Michigan, so my mother should always be talking about Viola Davis. I didn't watch the broadcast, but I did watch her speech.
Right.
And I'm wondering, and her speech was, I mean, it was beautiful. Every single speech that she delivers.
Yeah, they always are.
Beautiful.
Right.
But she touched on, like, so many different things. She touched on, obviously, fences and, like, the legacy of August Wilson and the everyman
Shout
sort
to
of
August
that
Wilson, who is so important. I feel like he's not underrated, because I hate when people say somebody is underrated, because that sort of takes away the love that they're already getting from the people that know about him or her, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But August Wilson, I think, and just sort of public consciousness is not as beloved as he should be.
I would agree.
But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, but I was just going to ask, she talked about August Wilson. She talked about his legacy of sort of like being a champion for the everyman.
Right.
And also, like, you know, she always, as she always does, a nod to her humble beginnings. And I'm wondering, like, you were just like, Viola Davis Oscar speech, drop the mic. Like, what did you want to talk about? What was in there that was on your mind?
I saw, because I didn't really watch it in real time either. When she won, two friends texted me, and then I saw the speech later online.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember seeing a joke on Twitter the next day. They were like, somebody, she should win an award for all the speeches that she gives, right? Because they're all so good.
Yeah.
And then somebody else was like, she should just drop a mixtape of her speeches, which I also agree with.
I agree.
She should literally, it's literally like Iyanla Fixed My Life is like Viola Fixed My Life. If she had like a tape or something that people could listen to, like, you know how much that would sell?
She could win that Grammy.
Yeah. I still want it to be almost like a mixtape and have it be like DJ Drama or DJ Cannon, like in between, like Cannon, you know, like, and then she comes in, like,
or like Funk Flex dropping bombs in between.
Like, I would buy that real quick.
But there is this. So right, so she's talking about sort of the everydayness that we don't always acknowledge in the public space, and I think Fences for her was that opportunity and just the roles that I think she takes on, right? Mm-hmm. She was in The Help, which I never saw, but she mm-hmm. was a black maid in The Help.
Yeah.
She plays the sort of not your typical black lawyer on How to Get Away with Murder. Mm-hmm. A black woman who has agency, right? Which you don't always see on television.
Ooh, yeah.
And a black woman who's not afraid to be herself, which is beautiful in its own right. But I think there's this she's so special in the way that I think you were saying how your mom just like loves her. She's so special to us because you can tell when somebody loves us, right? You can tell when somebody is trying to put that love back into the community, when she recognizes our beauty and she wants to share that with the world, right? So I just think I'm just so grateful for her and to her to sort of be able to articulate that time and again, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. In front of white folks, but also in front of us to realize, to, you know, hey, I'm here with you guys and I see you guys mm-hmm. and I recognize you guys and we're going to keep doing this, you know, it's important. I'm really excited, too, because Denzel, I heard they signed like some deal where they're also going to produce a few more of August Wilson's plays for the screen.
That yes. sounds amazing. Yes.
So I'm so excited. That Century Cycle is so important.
It's yeah. so
for people who don't, I don't know if this might
no, no, please. No, yeah.
So the August Wilson Century Cycle, he wrote a play for each decade of the 1900s. Yes. And so Fences was the 40s, 50s?
40s, I think it might have been the 50s.
I think it was the 50s, yeah.
Yeah. But he has a play for each decade, and it's probably one of the most phenomenal pieces of just body of work that I've ever been able to sort of yeah. like experience. And I haven't seen all the plays, but I've read most of them.
I think I've read most of them. Jitney right now on Broadway.
Yeah.
Shout out to Andre Holland.
Shout out to Brandon J. Dearden. I'm a big fan of like the whole cast of Jitney.
I haven't seen it. Yet. I want to see it. I wish plays weren't so expensive.
I know.
They're a little elitist in that way where it's like only certain people can see these stories, but I do want to see Jitney.
Yeah, I agree.
So this wasn't part of her speech. I saw footage of this later when she was taking questions backstage.
Uh-huh.
And then somebody asked her, what do you love about being a black woman? And obviously this was a white person because another black person never asked
no,
another black
that's
person
a
is. And then she
question.
Said, she summed it up so easy. She said everything.
Yeah. And she said it with such like,
she was like, what?
She was like, what? Everything.
How did I not see that?
It was, I mean, it was a real quick bite, but it was, yeah.
She's amazing.
Real.
I might just like delete every podcast feed that I have and just have that clip. People go, they're like, download episode. Just Viola Davis talking about loving being a black woman. That to me is better than the whole sum of my body of work. Well, like Viola Davis, you know, she sees us, she loves us, she wants us to know that we're valued. I think that you do that a lot with your work. And I really do.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It was this. So what? Shout out to Kiese Lehman, who was one of sort of my mentors at Gawker. He was one of our contributing editors, but he oversaw the true stories that we would run on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the sort of long essays, and then eventually we sort of expanded that, and we were doing that a lot more during the week.
Yeah.
But one of the early things that he taught me was that this idea of decentering whiteness from the conversation. So a lot of times I think blackness is in reaction to whiteness, or blackness is just sort of like, it's in reaction, but it's also like it's always somehow coming back to whiteness in a way that it shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he does a lot in his writing, which I admire, and there are a few other writers that do this very well, is that when they write, they're talking to other black people. They're not necessarily trying to translate it for white folks, mm-hmm. right? Which I think happens a lot in writing or essay writing these days. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it's been a lot about decentering whiteness from the center of this sort of like conversation that we're trying to have. And just speak amongst ourselves, sort of what this podcast is doing, or sort of what Moonlight was doing, how blackness was the default Because imagine when blackness is the default. You're not having these surface level conversations about blackness. You're not talking about this sort of basic blackness isn't just this one thing, which we always seem to come back to. We're talking beyond it so much that we're not even talking about it anymore, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of me, what I've been trying to do as an editor. And I think as I try to pivot a little bit and do more writing, I'll be trying to do in the writing as well.
Looking forward to that.
Ready. Ready.
Out here ready for the revolution.
Hey, ready.
I'm just trying to be like your hat and get free.
Shout out to my coworker Lake, and she makes these get free.
I need one.
I have
That's
to get
beautiful.
Y'all one. Yeah.
Yes.
They come in different colors. So,
yes.
You know. Shout out to Black entrepreneurs. Just
yes.
Hey, get the money.
Get that money.
Just get the money.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me. This is amazing.
Oh my gosh. Our pleasure. Yeah. Seriously.
Anytime we want to come back, just let us know.
Let us know. Holla
at us. It's a little early on a Sunday for me, but I'd love to come back. Maybe later this year.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. You are fantastic.
Yes.
And speaking of black businesses. Speaking of black businesses, you can actually support a black business by donating to For Colored Nerds on Patreon.
Yes. Patreon.com/ForColoredNerds.
Yes.
Just go there. Anything that you are able to contribute allows us to keep this show going.
Yes.
We do need it.
Sadly, it
is not cheap to do this.
No, sadly, it's not cheap to do this. So every single dollar counts. And you can donate as little as $1 for $12 a year. You too can be a part of the For Color Nerds magic. I don't know if that's a stretch. I don't know if that's
I'll
a
roll
stretch.
With it. Yeah.
Hashtag reparations.
Hey. But another way you can support us is to go to iTunes or your other, like, however you listen to podcasts, if there's a review system, and leave us a review.
Yes.
Yes, we really appreciate it. It helps people to discover our show.
Yes.
And to know that, you know, we not about no bullshit, that we come out here real.
Yes.
What do you say? Third eye open?
Third eye open. My third eye is open. But thank you guys so much for listening. This has been another poppin' edition of For Colored Nerds. The show is produced by me, Brittany Luce, and my partner, Eric Eddings, and also our producer, Bethel Habte. Copyright 2017. I don't know what else I'm supposed to say. Trademark. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, that is the point. Look out for us in about 2 weeks.
In about 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll be back soon.
Stay healthy.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.